Thank you, Tom, and thank you for everyone coming out this afternoon. I'm going to talk a little bit about freshwater subaqueous soils and some of the work that we've been recently doing. I've been doing this work with my graduate student, Jonathan Bach, and you'll see some pictures of Jonathan in the presentation. So he's sort of the guy that's taller than me. So anyway, you'll see him in here. Okay. If you're not aware, in the second edition of soil taxonomy, the definition of soils was changed to accommodate soils, subaqueous soils. And really, there's a number of reasons for this, but one of the major ones is that as time goes on, we sort of recognize how important these shallow water systems are and that we should look at them as resources. And so that's basically how we look at them. And we're trying to use soils information to basically manage those systems. The basic question is, why stop mapping soils and making interpretations at that water-land interface? I mean, that's sort of the question that we asked a long time ago. And I like to use this slide to sort of get at that. When I'm talking with my undergraduate students in my soils and land use class, you know, I tell them that the most essential things on Earth are water and soil. I mean, we can't live without that. And to them, it's really no different than pizza and beer. I mean, you got to have both of those things, okay? And so it's the same thing with the water and soil. If you have enough money, you can buy this piece of property right here, okay? Nobody owns this. It doesn't matter how much money you have, you can't buy the water, okay? But this piece of property right here and its value is really dependent upon those resources, that water resources and the soils that are there. And so, it's really important that we understand that there's this relationship between the soils and water. And we do understand that relationship, and we talk about it all the time in the subaerial soils, but now we have to basically put both of those things together. Maxine talked about the seamless soil survey. We need a seamless soil survey that includes the subaqueous and the subaerial soils. These are just some reasons why we've been working in the estuarine subaqueous soil systems. And maybe two slides ago that Maxine had up here, you saw some of these terms like restoration, management, preservation, habitats, things like that. That's the same reasons and the same interpretations that we do for these subaqueous soils. And we have to ask some other questions or some needs of our communities. People are asking for detailed bathymetric maps. What happens when we dig a channel? We have to maintain that channel. What do we do with those dredge materials? If we dredge, what does it do to the ecology of those systems? If we put those dredge materials on the land, can we use them for positive things? Are we going to get acid sulfate issues? So those are all some questions that we ask in the estuarine environments. And that's why when we look at this map of areas or states that we've had subaqueous soil investigations, that's why essentially all of these things or all these surveys were done and all these projects were done, because they're asking those questions and people are asking those questions. And really, of this list that you see right here, there's just a single one that was done in freshwater in a small pond in Massachusetts. And so we're trying to advance our what we know about freshwater subaqueous soils. So why would we want to map the freshwater? Pretty much the same reasons that we would want to map the estuarine. You know, we need a tool to manage these systems, okay? And to treat them as resources and not just a water, and at an ecosystem scale. We're trying to introduce sustainability in all our land use and so forth, and it's important that we do it here as well. There's lots of problems in lakes and ponds, and I think folks are aware of this, of managing the nitrogen and the phosphorus that goes into the systems. And it's possible that with the subaqueous soils, we can help manage that. There's a lot of other issues that you have to deal with sedimentation, whether they have metals that are combined, pesticides, herbicides, things like that. And then one of the big issues that a lot of people are trying to address are invasive species. And so there's a number of reasons that we want to work in these systems. And then we have these technical services that people are asking about, sedimentation rates, What's the water volume in the ponds? What if I want to put in a dock? What are the contaminant levels here? What about floodplain restoration? There's all cultural needs, resource needs. People want bathymetric map. You know, when we talk about making a subaqueous soil survey, you know, folks don't know a whole lot about soils, but they do know about bathymetry if they're working in the water, and so that's an important thing. Lots of folks are interested in dam removals or putting in fish ladders, and so that's important. And then with the whole global change, carbon accounting is a big issue. And really, there's very little information about how much carbon is stored in the system. So there's a lot of reasons why we're looking at them. Our project here, we have a number of objectives. Try to characterize some of the freshwater subaqueous soils. Again, we know very little about the soil types that are here. Do something about calculating the carbon pools. Try to look at the distribution of some of the nutrients in these systems, particularly phosphorus and nitrogen. To map the systems, we need to develop our relationships between the soils and the landforms, but also what we can do is try to make that relationship between maybe areas that we have invasive species and to estimate some of the sedimentation rates. So sort of the bigger goals are some of the goals that we would have is to try to learn some more about these soils so that we can update our soil taxonomy. We've done quite a bit of work in the estuarine systems, as I said, very little work in the freshwater system. So we might need to sort of update the methods or come up with some new methods that might be important. I talked about developing the soil landscape relationships, and so that's important. And then, you know, in a lot of areas, they don't have natural ponds or lakes, and there's a lot of reservoirs and things like that. And how are the soils different in those impounded systems, like a reservoir compared to a natural lake? So that's one of the questions that we also try to ask. Really, my goal here is to try to let you guys know, if you're not aware, that you can go and do this. It's not impossible. It's not that difficult. And you really just need to take that first step, and you'll be on your way. A little bit about the studies that we're doing. We're working in six systems. Three of them are impounded, so the ones that you see here on the map, Bowdish, Smith Sales, and Belleville, those are created ponds. And then the natural ones, Watchog, Wardens, and Tucker. So those are our comparative sites. I guess I should say here that it's not my intention to try to get folks to map every single water body that's out there. I think it's like our soil survey. If there's a need, you should go and do it. And I think the same thing with the freshwater soils. If there's an issue in those bodies of water that you think you can resolve with the soil survey, or at least have some resource information for folks that they can apply, then I think that's a good reason to do it. And these are some areas that are important in Rhode Island, and that's why we're working in them. When you're making a subaqueous soil survey, the first thing that we typically do is make a bathymetric map. And this seems pretty complicated if you haven't done it before, but actually, if you've ever driven in a boat and fished and used a fish finder, that's pretty much what you need to use. And if you can take a GPS out there and then download that information to a computer, you can take the information that you get from the fathometer, the fish finder, and you can download it and create a bathymetric map. And you essentially just drive around in the boat and collect the information. Actually, it's kind of boring. And Jonathan would say that, you know, he would drive for, I don't know, a half an hour or something like that, and then he had his fishing rod and cast out for, you know, 5 minutes or something like that. Sometimes he'd catch some nice fish, so he was happy about that. So anyway, that's basically what you do, and then, you know, you have to have a data point to set that to, an elevation point. And one of the things that Marty Ravenhorst and I were talking about this morning is that there's a lot of difficulty in the tide corrections when you're doing the bathymetric maps in the estuarine systems. Well, in the freshwater systems, it's really not an issue. And so it makes it so much easier when you're creating these maps. And there's, you know, a number of softwares that you can use to create the bathymetric maps. The first thing, once you have the bathymetric map, is to delineate what we call the soil landscape units. And you can see some rough delineations that I did here. And it, when you have the nice orthos, and we have nice orthos now to use as base maps, you can use that information and then the bathymetric lines or the topo lines, and it's pretty easy to delineate the landscape units, the soil landscape units. And then we'll run a transect across them, okay? And we've been using the GPR in the freshwater systems. You can't use it in the estuarine systems, which is unfortunate because of the salts in those systems, but I'll show you some screenshots of some of the GPR, and you'll see how well that works. And then, you know, if you've got some extra money or something like that, you can also drag along a video at the bottom, and you can pick up some things on the bottom that'll help you with the mapping. Both of these things sort of support, or the video can help support the GPR images. How do you do the GPR in the water? So here's our tin boat. It's about a 14-foot aluminum boat, so not very expensive. In some of the ponds or lakes, we can use an outboard. And others you can't, so we have electric trolling motor. And we just have this rubber raft that we troll behind there, and we put the GPR on, and that's how we collect our transect data. All right. Where we live, sometimes it gets cold, and so there's nothing to do in the wintertime, so we get out on the ice. And if we're not ice fishing, then maybe we'll bring the GPR with or something like that. And so you can just walk across the ice, and you have to have some special shoes on. You know, we just wear some cleats or and that helps you go. And so there's another way that you can do your transects. And then here's your here's the images right here, just a couple screenshots, but I'm going to move over here. See, but very clearly you can pick up the water really nicely. And then these lines are really representative of organics, and you see it all the time. Here's some thicker organics where we have histosols. Here's some thinner organics where we have histic epipedons. The mineral soils show up very well. Different soil types you can see in the different patterns in the GPR. Surface roughness and so forth, very smooth up here, so we know that it's probably fine deposits. Then you get some rougher surfaces like over there, and you can tell that there's surface stones, and then the boulders come up really well. So the GPR does an excellent job. I had my doubts in the beginning, but I don't have my doubts anymore, and I was very happy with the images, and when we went out to field test them, they came out perfect. So you do ground truth the GPR, you investigate the soils, and then from that you start to build your soil landscape models. And what do we use for sampling? Well, you use the same equipment that you use for the most part in your subaerial soils, a bucket auger. We use a Macaulay-Peat sampler all the time in our soft materials or organics, and so we use that. When we want to have a pedon that we're going to describe and characterize fully, we'll try to take a vibrocore. What you see here is a raft that we built that we can tow along with that little tin boat and take out to wherever we want to do our vibrocores. And here's a vibrocore over here. If you haven't seen one before, here's a profile, and you get a really nice exposure of the soil that you can sample and describe. So something about the soil types that are in these systems. If you're not aware of it, subaqueous soils were added as suborders in soil taxonomy this year in the Keys. And so under the entosols and histosols, we have wasents and wasists. So at the suborder level, we now have these subaqueous soils. These are the wasent great groups. And the first one that classifies out is the frozzy wasents, which are the freshwater ones. And those are the ones that I'm talking about today. So I'm going to go on. These are the subgroups for the wasent. So you have hydric, lithic, somentic, haptohistic, thaptohistic, effluventic, aeric, and then your typic or your other ones. Just a little bit about trying to figure out which ones of these are out there. It's really not that bad. The hydric ones are the ones with high N values, so the Macaulay is a perfect sampler for those, and you can figure that out. Lithic, you can see on the GPR, or if you're not using GPR, if you can use a bucket auger to find the lithic. Somentic are very sandy, and so you can find those. Thaptohistic have organic layers under recent sediment, and so if you use the bucket auger to get through the recent sediment, you can push your Macaulay through the organic materials. The fluventic are usually around where stream systems are coming in, and then the aeric are around near shores. Either they're buried subaerial soils or where groundwater is coming in, and so you get the brighter color. As far as the histosols, you have the phrosiwasis, the freshwater ones classifying first. These are the subgroups that you get, fibric, sapric, and then typic, the ones you should be familiar with. And so if you think about it, there's really not that many soils that you have out there, at least that you can classify to the subgroup level. Here's a Macaulay sample of a sapric phrosiwasis. Okay, you can see that. In some cases, we have these histics over top of mineral soils, and so really they would classify out, at least under the current taxonomy, as an inceptisol. We don't have wasseps yet, but anyway, this would be an example of a phrosiwasset. This is a preliminary subaqueous soils map, and so you can get a picture that these things follow the landscape. Okay, just a preliminary map, but you get an idea that they follow the landscape. Just some mention about invasive species, one of the things that we're interested in. We're trying to relate that to some of our map units. We're just in the beginning stages of this, but in some of the ponds we have milfoil problems and fanwort problems. And carbon, we're interested in carbon pools. The ones that have histic epipedons, they have as much carbon as a very poorly drained soil. Okay, so a lot of carbon in these systems. And then when you look at the organic soils, they have as much as our organic soils in the subaerial systems. Lastly, I'd like to thank the NRCS. Some of the funds to support this project has come from the Soil Survey Office, and also from our Rhode Island office that are really interested. This past summer, we ran the Subaqueous Soils Workshop, the National Subaqueous Soils Workshop, and there was over 30 people that attended. Hopefully, if you're in the audience, hopefully you got a lot out of that. If you're interested in this and you have some questions, please contact me or Jim Tureen, our state soil scientist, who we work with very closely. Or just come up, and we're working in the systems, and we're more than willing to show you around, okay, and if you have some questions. So.